dudes in space. There were a pair of turtles gazing skyward, an homage to the winner of the race between the tortoise and the hare, celebrating the deliberate and methodical approach. But there was also an hourglass, symbolizing human mortality, and the need to move expeditiously. Before he had made his fortune at Amazon, Bezos had been outbid at the Sotheby's auction of space memorabilia. But in the years since, he had more than made up for it. Here was a Mercury-era NASA hard hat, an Apollo 1 training suit, and a heat shield tile from the space shuttle. Then there was the curious piece of art tucked away in the corner. It was composed of 442 spools of thread stacked vertically on top of one another, as if in a spice rack. Together, they looked like nothing more than the inside of a massive sewing kit, the random assortment of colors amounting to nothing. But if you looked at it through the glass sphere hanging from the wall, the spools morphed into a portrait of Leonardo da Vinci, appearing as if by magic. Amid the assortment of space artifacts, the piece seemed out of place, as if the curators got confused and hung an impressionist painting in the Air and Space Museum, Degas' ballet dancers hanging next to the F1 engine hardware. But here in Bezos's Wonderland, where Dr. Seuss's quote was painted on the wall, "If you want to catch beasts you don't see every day, you have to go places quite out of the way," it made sense. Going to space required looking through the prism to see that which was otherwise invisible. In a conference room called Jupiter 2, Bezos settled into a chair with a cup of black coffee and nibbled from a small bowl of assorted nuts. After years of secrecy, Blue Origin was starting to finally open up, and had even invited a small group of reporters to the headquarters a year before. But Bezos rarely granted one-on-one interviews like this, even to the Washington Post, the newspaper he had bought in 2013. It had taken me months of persistent cajoling to get this meeting. The key, it seemed, was a press release from 1961 I'd discovered in the archives, highlighting the service of his grandfather, Lawrence P. Guise, as he left the Advanced Research Projects Agency to go back to the Atomic Energy Commission. Buttonholing Bezos after an event and handing him the press release was a last-ditch effort to get him to sit down for an interview. His grandfather was an important figure to him. Perhaps I could win him over with my level of research. The world had seen him almost exclusively through the lens of Amazon. But to truly understand him, it also had to see him through another of his real passions, space. This was an important moment in the history of human space travel, one that needed to be more thoroughly chronicled. Would he be willing to sit down and talk about his ambitions building rockets? He studied the release, looked at the photo of his grandfather, and listened to the pitch. "I'm inclined to participate," he said carefully. It took another couple of months for "inclined" to solidify into a yes. When Martin Baron, the executive editor of the Post, interviewed Bezos at a conference hosted by the paper, he acknowledged the tricky and potentially perilous position he was in. In journalism, interviewing the owner of the company is considered to be high-risk behavior, he said. As a Washington Post reporter, the same was true for me now. Relaxed and in a good mood, sitting in the Jupiter 2 conference room, Bezos began to talk about his long-held passion for space and what he hoped to accomplish. Amazon was still very much his primary occupation, something he was passionate about, especially as it had branched out from selling books to selling nearly everything. But on Wednesdays, he stole away to Blue's headquarters in Kent, Washington, about 20 miles south of downtown Seattle. Wednesdays were for space. His girlfriend from high school had once told an interviewer that Bezos had founded Amazon in order to make enough money to start a space company. Now, on this Wednesday in May 2017, he conceded that there is some truth to that. The great fortune, which now stood at more than $80 billion, had allowed him to found Blue Origin. While Musk had initially invested $100 million of his own money into SpaceX, the company had also benefited from more than $4 billion in contracts from NASA. By contrast, Bezos was his own NASA, funding Blue Origin almost entirely on his own. He'd joked that Blue Origin's business model has been, I sell about $1 billion a year of Amazon stock, and I use it to invest in Blue Origin. He bought the Washington Post for $250 million in 2013. By contrast, he spent $2.5 billion of his own money on the New Glenn rocket alone, without accepting any government investment. But Amazon was a real passion, he said, and no mere stepping stone for Blue. Bezos had recently been to the Oscars, where Amazon Studios' film Manchester by the Sea had won an Academy Award. Alexa, Amazon's personal home assistant, was a hit, and the company was getting deeper into artificial intelligence. And groceries. Soon Amazon would acquire Whole Foods. There was plenty there to keep him occupied at what he called his day job. I've fallen in love with it, he said. He'd fallen in love with Blue, too. If you asked Alexa what she thought of Donald Trump, for example, she'd respond by saying, "When it comes to politics, I like to think big. We should be funding deep space exploration. I'd love to answer questions from Mars." And he had also recently scored a small role playing an alien in the film Star Trek Beyond. A few days earlier, Bezos had been to the Seattle Museum of Flight, where the F-1 Apollo-era engines he had recovered from the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean had just gone on display. He had come to speak to a group of schoolchildren about the mission and his interest in the cosmos, how from a young age he was passionate about space, rockets, rocket engines, space travel. "We all have passions," he told the students sitting before him on the floor. "You don't get to choose them. They pick you. But you have to be alert to them. You have to be looking for them. And when you find your passion, it's a fantastic gift for you because it gives you direction. It gives you purpose. You can have a job, you can have a career, or you can have a calling." His calling had come to him when he was 5 years old, as he watched Neil Armstrong take the first steps on the moon. Sitting in the conference room, he said, "I have a very distinct memory," he said, "of the lunar mission and the moment space took hold of him." His grandparents and mother were huddled around the television. "I remember the excitement in the room," he continued. "And I remember the black and white TV." Most of all, he remembered the sense that something important was happening. Something important was happening at Blue as well. Not far from where Bezos was seated, crews on the factory floor were building the next generation of New Shepard rockets, the ones that could take humans to space. Over the past year, Blue had flown the same New Shepard booster 5 times in a row, with minimal refurbishment in between flights, pulling off precise landings each time and proving that reusability was possible. After each flight, the company painted a tortoise on the booster, a reminder of the slow, deliberate path. And the company had a new motto: launch, land, repeat. The next step would be flying people on suborbital trips just past the edge of space. First would come test passengers, not pilots. The rocket flew itself autonomously, whose sole job would be to rate the experience from a customer's point of view. Were the seats comfortable? How was the view? Were the handles in the right place? Then would come the first space tourists, himself included. "My singular focus is people in space," Bezos said. "I want people in space." As a young child, he had wanted to be an astronaut. But as he got older and studied rocketry, he realized that he wanted to also be an engineer. Armstrong was a hero, but he also admired Wernher von Braun, the German-born chief architect of the Apollo-era Saturn V rocket. "I think he would also be quite disappointed that we aren't further out into space," Bezos said in response to a question about what von Braun would think of the state of the current space program. "I think he'd be shocked that nobody had been back to the moon. I think he'd be shocked that the record for the maximum number of humans in space at any one time is 13. He would be like, 'What have you guys been up to? What, I die and the whole thing stops? Dudes, get on with it.'" Years after Virgin Galactic started touting its space tourism program, it now was about to have competition. Richard Branson was promising all the luxuries that had been associated with the glamorous Virgin brand. But with Amazon, Bezos had a long history of customer service experience that he was bringing to Blue. 2 days before the launch, Blue's passengers would arrive in West Texas, the company said on its website, where the area's isolation lends clarity and focus as you prepare for the experience of a lifetime. A day-long training session would include an overview of the rocket and spacecraft, safety briefings, a simulation of the mission, and maneuvering in a weightless environment. Everything you need to know to make the most of your experience as an astronaut. On the morning of the flight, as many as 6 passengers would board the spacecraft 30 minutes before launch time. Inside the capsule, with its white padded walls, they'd strap into reclined, Lazy Boy-like seats, each positioned next to a massive window, the biggest ever to fly into space. They'd blast off in a burst of fire and smoke. Soon the capsule would separate from the booster and float past the edge of space. The passengers would then unbuckle their seatbelts and have 4 minutes to float around the cabin, weightless. Thrusters would slowly spin the capsule to give passengers a 360-degree view. Then they'd strap themselves back into the seats, and the spacecraft would fall back toward Earth under parachutes before touching down in the desert. In all, the entire trip would last 10 or 11 minutes. No one sold space like Branson did, promising his customers a once-in-a-lifetime experience. But now Blue was getting into marketing mode, touting its program in similarly lofty tones. When you first look out through these massive windows, you just lose yourself in the panorama of blue and black, former NASA astronaut Nicholas Patrick, who worked as Blue's human integration architect, said in a promotional video the company posted on its website. You can see clearly for millions of light years in every direction. It gives you a sense of the scale of the universe. The minute you unstrap, you're free. It opens up the possibilities for movement that you've just never, ever had here on Earth. It's a shared experience with your crew, but it's also profoundly personal. So you really feel a part of the unfathomable depths of the cosmos. And a connection to Earth. At least that's what the astronauts always said. That they went to space only to discover home. The crew of Apollo 8 had made it all the way to the far side of the moon. And then, as they came around the bend, there it was. The pale blue dot, half lit on the horizon. A frail planet, suspended in the darkness, alone. Their Earthrise photograph would become one of the most iconic images in the history of still photography. In mid-2017, Bezos invited several of the surviving Apollo-era astronauts to an air show in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, where he was showing off the new Shepard booster and a mock-up of the crew capsule that would soon take paying tourists to space. It was an extraordinary reunion of the most exclusive of fraternities. There was Buzz Aldrin, and James Lovell and Frank Borman, both members of the Apollo 8 crew, along with Fred Hayes, who had served with Lovell on Apollo 13. There were Walter Cunningham, Apollo 7, and Gene Kranz, NASA's legendary flight director. One by one, they stepped into Bezos' spacecraft, crossing the chasm from Apollo to the promise of the next giant leap, even if so many of their brethren had passed away and would never see it come to fruition. They stretched out in the reclined seats next to the giant windows of this newly designed crew capsule and ran their fingers over the handrails there to provide stability during those minutes of weightlessness. Bezos was thrilled. These were his heroes. "Space changes people," he said, welcoming them. Every time you talk to an astronaut, somebody who has been into space, they will tell you that when you look back at Earth and see how beautiful it is and how fragile it is and that thin layer of the Earth's atmosphere, that it makes you really appreciate home. No one knew that more than the men assembled in his spacecraft. "That was all heart," Bezos later said of the gathering. "I felt so many emotions and had 3 of my 4 kids there." Space had been a dream for decades, and he was looking forward to experiencing weightlessness, seeing the curvature of Earth, the blackness of space. I will go. I definitely will go. I can't wait, actually. He had said that in 2007 on Charlie Rose, but now he was finally getting close to his dream. For years, Blue Origin had been obsessively secretive, the tortoise holed up in his protective shell, not wanting to attract attention to himself, content to let the hare steal the show. "We'll talk about Blue Origin when we have something to talk about," Bezos said at one point. Now, it had something to talk about, and had begun opening up ever so slightly. Over the course of several months, starting in early 2016, as New Shepard flew and flew again, and as Bezos collected a series of awards on behalf of Blue Origin's groundbreaking landings, he made it clear in speeches and interviews that his ambitions went far beyond simply flying tourists to the edge of space and back. After spending so many years researching and testing, he told a small group of reporters that he invited to Blue for a first-ever media tour. "Really exciting, cool stuff that's not just hype is coming out the other end." Without mentioning Musk by name, he said that space is really easy to overhype. He continued, "There are very few things in the world where the ratio of attention you get to what you've actually done can be extreme." When asked about Musk, he said they are very like-minded about a lot of things. "We're not twins about our conceptualization about the future." Bezos wanted to go to Mars, yes, but also everywhere else. Musk liked to call Mars a fixer-upper of a planet, one that he said could be heated up and made habitable in the event that an asteroid hit Earth and threatens to wipe out humanity. Bezos seemed skeptical that Mars could be a backup for the human race. To my friends who say they want to move to Mars one day, I say, "Why don't you go live in Antarctica first for 3 years, and then see what you think," he said at a conference at the Washington Post. "Because Antarctica is a garden paradise compared to Mars." "Think about it," he said at another point. "On Mars, there was no whiskey, no bacon, no swimming pools, no oceans, no hiking, no urban centers. Eventually, Mars might be amazing, but that's a long way in the future." NASA had visited every planet in the solar system, he would say. "And believe me, Earth is the best one. This planet is incredible. There are waterfalls and beaches and palm trees and fantastic cities and restaurants and parties and events like this. And you're not going to get that anywhere but Earth for a really, really long time." The better plan, then, was to preserve this gem called Earth. "We don't want Mars as a plan B," he said. "Plan B is to make sure plan A works. And plan A is to make sure we keep this planet around for thousands of years." It had become something of a well-honed stump speech, told over and over with remarkable consistency. Then again, using space as a way to preserve Earth was a concept he had been thinking about since high school. "The whole idea is to preserve the Earth," he had told the Miami Herald in 1982 after his high school valedictorian speech. He was 18 and saying Earth should be designated as a national park. Now, 4 decades later, he had revised his speech, only slightly. Instead of using the national park line, he said that Earth should be zoned residential and light industrial. The point was the same. All heavy industry would move into space. He now called this the Great Inversion, mining for energy resources in space while leaving Earth alone. This planet was finite, Bezos said, lacking the resources to keep up with the demand of a world growing ever more developed and dynamic. "There's all kinds of interesting stuff you can do around the solar system, but the thing that's going to move the needle for humanity the most is mining near-Earth objects and building manufacturing infrastructure in place," he said, as he sat in the conference room at Blue Origin. "That's the big thing." That would be in the distant future, after he was gone. "Unless somebody does a good job on life extension," he added. But it was not that far in the future. We only have a couple hundred years. If you take baseline energy usage today, compound it at just a few percent a year for just a few hundred years, and you have to cover the entire Earth's surface with solar cells to keep up with demand, he said. You either go out into space, or you need to control population on Earth. You need to control energy usage on Earth. These things are totally at odds with a free society, and it's going to be dull. I want my great-great-grandchildren to be using more energy per capita than I do. And the only way they can be using more energy per capita than me is if we expand out into the solar system. And then we can really keep Earth as this incredible gem that it is. Blue Origin's oft-repeated goal was millions of people living and working in space. But over the long term, it was even more ambitious than that. If we want, we could have a trillion human beings living in the solar system, he said during an awards ceremony in Washington. And then we'll have 1,000 Einsteins and 1,000 Mozarts. What a cool civilization that would be. When he started Amazon, the infrastructure was already in place so that a startup internet company, even in 1995, could be successful. Now he wanted to start building the transportation network to space. While he had been inspired by the achievements during the Apollo era, the country's human spaceflight program had been treading water for a long time, he said. And during an interview at the Vanity Fair New Establishment Summit, he sounded very much like Musk, speaking about creating a cargo route to space that would be similar to the railroads that opened up the West. What I want to achieve with Blue Origin is to build the heavy lifting infrastructure that allows for the kind of dynamic, entrepreneurial explosion of thousands of companies in space that I have witnessed over the last 21 years on the internet, he said. Amazon had its path laid out for it. Cables for the internet had been laid. The postal service delivered packages to his customers. There was already a payment system. We didn't have to do that, he said. It was called the credit card, and it had been initially put in place for travelers. All Amazon had to do then was take that infrastructure and kind of reassemble it in a new way and do something new and inventive with it. In space today, that is impossible. On the internet today, two kids in their dorm room can reinvent an industry because the heavy lifting infrastructure is in place for that. Two kids in their dorm room can't do anything interesting in space. He wanted, then, to use his vast fortune to lay the foundation of that infrastructure into space, to make that part of his legacy. If I'm 80 years old, and I'm looking back on my life, he said during an award ceremony, and I can say that I put in place, with the help of the teammates at Blue Origin, the heavy lifting infrastructure that made access to space cheap and inexpensive so that the next generation could have the entrepreneurial explosion like I saw on the internet, I'll be a very happy 80-year-old. But first, a relatively small step. Blue Origin would have to get good at launching, reliably, efficiently, affordably, over and over, so that the act of going to space would become routine. Although suborbital space tourism had been derided by some as trivial, like bungee jumping in reverse for the super rich, as one science fiction author said, Bezos saw it as vital. If nothing else, the flights would be good practice. We humans don't get great at things we do a dozen times a year, Bezos said during a Q&A in 2016. Launching rockets at such a rate was just not enough to get great at it. You never want to get a surgeon who operates just a dozen times a year. If you need to have surgery, find somebody who does the operation 20 to 25 times a week. That's the right level of practice. Space tourism, then, was not just a way for people, albeit wealthy people, to experience space, but it was a way to make space more accessible. Tourism often leads to new technologies, Bezos said at the Washington Post Forum. And then those new technologies often circle back around and get used in very important utilitarian ways. Graphic processing units, or GPUs, for example, were invented for video games. But now they're being used for machine learning, he said. In addition to the 10-minute jaunts to space, the future for Blue Origin involved a much larger, more ambitious rocket. Internally, it had been called Very Big Brother. But now, it had a more formal name. New Glenn. After John Glenn, the first American in orbit. Compared to New Shepard, the new rocket would be a beast, with 7 engines, capable of 3.85 million pounds of thrust, towering as high as 313 feet, almost as tall as the Saturn V. 11 days before John Glenn died at the age of 95 in late 2016, he wrote Bezos a letter, saying he was deeply touched that the rocket was named after him. In 1962, when he took his historic flight into orbit, "You were still 2 years from being born," Glenn wrote. When Glenn returned to space in 1998 on a space shuttle mission at age 77, he noted that Blue Origin wouldn't be founded for another 2 years, but "you were already driven by a vision of space travel accessible not only to highly trained pilots and engineers and scientists, but to all of us." As the original Glenn, "I can tell you, I see the day coming when people will board spacecraft the same way millions of us now board jetliners. When that happens, it will be largely because of your epic achievements this year." Coming just days before the death of an American icon, the letter served as a bridge from the halcyon days of NASA's manned space program, Glenn's era of Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, to this new era, a time Bezos had started to call a new golden age of space exploration. New Glenn, the smallest orbital rocket he'd ever build, would be capable of not just flying satellites and humans to low Earth orbit, but beyond. In Florida, Blue was building a massive manufacturing facility where it would build New Glenn. It was also revamping Pad 36, the launch complex just down the road from SpaceX's 39A. Over the past year, the company had gone on a hiring spree and now had about 1,000 employees. Even though New Glenn was still at least 3 years from flying, in early 2017, Bezos announced that Blue had signed its first customer for the rocket, Eutelsat, a French satellite company. The deal would give Blue something that had been scarce in its history, actual revenue. And it marked the company's entrance into the market, where it would now compete against SpaceX. New Glenn was yet another demonstration in the step-by-step approach. First came New Shepard, named after the first American in space. That took about 10 years to develop. Then New Glenn, which by the time it was scheduled to fly in 2020, would mark the culmination of another decade of work. "We get to do a major thing every 10 years, Bezos said, sitting in the conference room at Blue Origin's headquarters. "I think before I'm 80, we have time for 2 more major cycles, maybe even 2.5. And so what those things will be, I don't need to decide that now. It's premature. But if I can stay healthy, I'd like to see it. I'll make sure somebody will continue the work, even if I'm not around to see it. I'd love to see it. I'm very curious about the future." Working just 1 day a week at Blue meant time was precious. He stood up and headed out to his next meeting. Wednesdays were for space. "And now I'm going to return to building rockets," he said as he walked out through the lobby. It was hard to know what the future would look like, hundreds of years out. But he had big plans for how he'd fulfill the dreams of his 5-year-old self. And he had recently given a very big hint about where he wanted to go. His next rocket would be named New Armstrong. Epilogue. Again, the moon. Paul Allen couldn't stay away. After Spaceship One had made history as the first commercial vehicle to reach the edge of space, he had licensed the technology to Richard Branson, unnerved by the danger of the endeavor and ready to turn his attention and fortune elsewhere. But space and aviation had been passions ever since he was a kid. And in 2011, he announced he was going to build the world's largest airplane. With a wingspan wider than a football field, end zones included, it would be larger than even the Spruce Goose, the famous aircraft Howard Hughes built during World War II that was designed to carry as many as 700 soldiers, but only flew once in 1947. Allen's plane wasn't designed to carry passengers. Rather, rockets that would drop from the plane's belly at 35,000 feet and then launch into space. Because of its size, it would be capable of carrying rockets far more powerful than Spaceship One, as well as carrying satellites, experiments, and eventually astronauts into orbit, not just to the threshold of space. With the Ansari X Prize, Allen had been at the vanguard of the commercial space movement, which was now dominated by his fellow billionaire tycoons, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and Branson, all of whom were pushing ahead with their own plans, showing it could be done. Allen wanted back in the game. "You have a certain number of dreams in your life you want to fulfill," he said at the time, "and this is a dream that I'm very excited about." His announcement came shortly after the space shuttle had flown its last mission, and NASA was suddenly unable to fly astronauts into space. Despite the progress made by SpaceX and others, it was an uncertain time for the future of human space travel. And he noted, "With government-funded spaceflight diminishing, there is a much expanded opportunity for privately funded efforts." His new venture would, he said, keep America at the forefront of space exploration. 5 years after that announcement, the plane was not yet ready to fly, but it was taking shape. Burt Rutan had retired from Scaled Composites, but Allen had hired his old company to build Stratolaunch in a massive hangar at the Mojave Air and Spaceport, which was so big the company had to apply for special construction permits just for the scaffolding. Sitting in his Seattle office in August 2017, with views of the harbor, with the Seahawks Super Bowl trophy nearby, he said that the plane was getting close to flying. Even unfinished, it was a behemoth. The wingspan seemed as long as a runway, and at 385 feet was longer than the distance traveled by the Wright brothers on their first powered flights at Kitty Hawk. Its landing gear had a total of 28 wheels. It had twin fuselages, and fully loaded, it would weigh as much as 1.3 million pounds, be powered by six 747 engines, and have 60 miles of cable coursing through it. In the history of aviation, there had never been anything quite like it. In addition to his fascination with space, Allen was a connoisseur of antique planes, and had amassed a collection of World War II relics that he had painstakingly refurbished. He recovered them from old battlefields. A Messerschmitt, a German fighter plane, was dug out of a sand dune on a French beach, where it had been buried for decades. An Ilyushin IL-2M3 Sturmovik was pieced together from the wrecks of four planes recovered in northwest Russia. To showcase his collection, Allen created a museum, the Flying Heritage and Combat Armor Museum in Everett, Washington, which featured a Grumman F-6F-5 Hellcat and a B-25 bomber, among others. "I would go in the university stacks and pull out books like Jane's Fighting Aircraft of World War II when I was 12 or something, and I'd spend hours reading about the engines in some of those planes," Allen recalled. "I was trying to understand how things worked, how things were put together, everything from airplane engines to rockets and nuclear power plants. I was just intrigued by the complexity and the power and the grace of these things flying." Now, he was building a plane as powerful and complex as any of them, built for opening up the cosmos. Allen's vision was like that of his fellow space barons, to lower the cost of space travel and make it more accessible. Bezos had said that inexpensive, reliable access to space would touch off the kind of dynamic, entrepreneurial explosion of thousands of companies in space that I have witnessed over the last 21 years on the Internet. Allen also saw parallels between the space frontier and the Internet. "When such access to space is routine, innovation will accelerate in ways beyond what we can currently imagine," he said. "That's the thing about new platforms. When they become easily available, convenient, and affordable, they attract and enable other visionaries and entrepreneurs to realize more new concepts. 30 years ago, the PC revolution put computing power into the hands of millions, and unlocked incalculable human potential. 20 years ago, the advent of the web and the subsequent proliferation of smartphones combined to enable billions of people to surmount the traditional limitations of geography and commerce. Today, expanding access to LEO, low Earth orbit, holds similar revolutionary potential. Just as computers had gone from the size of refrigerators to being able to fit in your pocket, once massive and expensive satellites were smaller and cheaper, some even the size of a shoebox. Being able to put up constellations of thousands of them at a time would allow for all sorts of endeavors, from beaming the internet to every spot in the world, opening up communication, to better monitoring the health of the planet, allowing farmers to keep a close eye on crops, and the Pentagon to monitor its enemies. The capabilities of these small satellites is something that's really interesting and fascinating, both for communications, where a lot of people are putting up constellations of satellites, and for monitoring the challenged health of our planet, he said, sitting in his office. He'd become particularly interested in how space could be used to keep an eye on things like illegal fishing in the ocean, which is an increasing problem. In mid-2017, Heather Wilson, the new U.S. Air Force Secretary, visited the company's hangar in Mojave to discuss how it could be used to launch satellites for national security. Stratolaunch, able to take off and land at airports, could be a key player in launching those satellites quickly and affordably, as space was quickly becoming the next frontier in war. While the XPRIZE flights had terrified him, Allen had begun to think about human space travel again. "I had to think long and hard about taking the plunge again," he wrote in his memoir. "Over time, my interest began to outweigh my reservations." Most exciting, for me, was the prospect of putting people into space for days and weeks at a time, Allen wrote. "I'd be happy to leave suborbital, high-volume space tourism to Richard Branson and Virgin Galactic, but there was something incomparably thrilling about orbital flight. Going back to John Glenn's ride on the Friendship 7, it's an experience that goes way beyond a 6-minute suborbital flight." Richard Branson was building Spaceship 2 for suborbital trips, but the company had been discussing the development of a more powerful rocket capable of sending humans into orbit. By 2017, Branson and Allen started discussing the possibility of launching that rocket off Stratolaunch in what would mark an extraordinary reunion. "The talks were preliminary, but we hope we can work together on it," Branson said. "It would be quite nice, actually, since we started together, if we could end up working together again." Allen didn't rule that out, but he also had plans of his own. In addition to creating a more reliable and efficient way to launch satellites, he was thinking bigger. Stratolaunch was so massive, it could carry not just one rocket at a time, but three, clustered under its belly like missiles on a fighter jet. But even three rockets wouldn't get close to the plane's capacity. He was also thinking about a reusable space shuttle, called Black Ice, that would be capable of flying to the International Space Station, taking satellites and experiments to orbit, and maybe one day, even people. The ultimate goal was to have airline-style operations, but for space, said John Floyd, Stratolaunch's chief executive officer. "You make your rocket a plane," he said. "So you have an airplane carrying a plane that's fully reusable. You don't throw anything away, ever. Only fuel." A space plane, capable of not just delivering satellites to orbit, but of staying up for at least 3 days, that could be launched from virtually anywhere in the world. It was still in the development phase, a risky, push-the-envelope theory that might not pan out. "I would love to see us have a full reusable system and have weekly, if not more often, airport-style, repeatable operations going," Allen said, while sitting in his Seattle office. Returning to human spaceflight was a possibility sometime in the future, he said. "If you caught the bug back in the Mercury era, of course it's in the back of your mind. But I think you're seeing right now, other than space station resupply missions, most space flights are about launching satellites. That's the reality, and they are extremely important for everything from television to data all over the world. You can get data in the Kalahari Desert, because there's a satellite up there." Virgin, meanwhile, had been taking out its new Spaceship Two, dubbed Unity, for test flights. Again and again, the mothership, White Knight Two, would hoist the space plane aloft, dropping it high above the Mojave Desert floor. Each test pushed the envelope further, until the company was finally getting close to the point where the testing program had been in 2014, when its spacecraft had come apart in midair. As the testing progressed, Branson played the refrain he'd been singing for years. First flights were just around the corner. Always just around the corner. After more than a decade of waiting to fly, Branson was nearing 70, and getting itchy, as were his customers.
"I'm getting on, so we're going to have to hurry up," he said.
Now he had competition in Bezos' Blue Origin, which he relished. The space tourism experiences would be markedly different. Virgin Galactic's space plane versus Blue Origin's more traditional rocket.
"My guess is that quite a lot of people will want to try one and then try the other," he said. "And it's going to be interesting to see which passenger experience people enjoy the most."
He made clear, though, who he thought had the advantage.
"We believe that going into space in a spaceship and coming back in that spaceship on wheels will be a customer experience that people would prefer than perhaps one or two other options that are being considered. And we'd love to see whether we're correct about that."
In February 2017, SpaceX bounced back from its explosion with a mix of aplomb and audacity. It christened historic Launch Pad 39A for the first time since the last of the shuttle missions, resurrecting the once dormant site with a fiery flight of the Falcon 9 on a cargo mission to the space station. A month earlier, the company had announced that it had found the cause of the explosion. Not a rifle shot, but a problem with a pressure vessel in the second stage liquid oxygen tank. The tank had buckled, the company reported, and supercooled liquid oxygen propellant had pooled in the lining. The fuel had been ignited by breaking fibers or friction. The Federal Aviation Administration had ruled out sabotage as a cause and granted SpaceX a launch license. Musk concluded that it was a self-inflicted wound. "It took us a long time, but we were able to recreate the failure. But it did alert us to the fact that sabotage was a real thing, so we upgraded the security." A few months later, when a crew from CBS's The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, which was being escorted by Boeing officials, stopped outside the gates to check out SpaceX's use of 39A, SpaceX called security on them. They were stopped, questioned, and had to show identification before being allowed to go. Without proof of foul play in the rocket explosion, SpaceX pressed ahead, confident that it could endure another failure, even if the pair of explosions had been a blow to the company's finances and reputation. "We've got cash in the bank, and we've got no debt," Gwynne Shotwell said at a press conference at the time. "So financially we're fine. It's hard to make money, though, in a year when you have a failure. So I'm not going to kid anybody to say that wasn't a painful financial year for us last year, and frankly 2015. But it doesn't mean we're not a healthy and a vibrant company. We could withstand another failure for sure. I would not have done my job properly had we not been prepared for that." Nothing cemented its status as the leader of the rising new industry than when the Falcon 9 lifted off from the same hallowed ground as the Apollo-era Saturn V, a launch that Musk called an incredible honor. Shortly after 9 a.m., the rocket rose with a thunderous, bone-rattling roar and then disappeared into a veil of low and dense clouds. 10 minutes later, however, it reappeared as it flew backward toward the landing pad, where it touched down softly. By now, booster landings had almost become routine for SpaceX. It had a growing collection of so-called flight-proven first stages, all of which had landed successfully, either on the landing pad or on the drone ship at sea. What SpaceX had not done, however, was to refly one of those used rocket boosters. Landings were a wonderful bit of performance art that got millions of clicks on YouTube, but from a business standpoint, they were meaningless unless the rockets could be flown again and again. As much as 70% of the cost of launch was in the booster stage, as Musk liked to say, It housed the most expensive and most important part of the Falcon 9, its 9 engines. The first flight of a previously flown booster came a month later, on a launch also from 39A. After the launch, an emotional Musk called it an incredible milestone in the history of space, one that SpaceX had been working toward for 15 years. This, he said, would be what would ultimately lower the cost of spaceflight, perhaps by a factor of 100 or more. The key to opening up space and becoming a spacefaring civilization, a multiplanetary species, and having the future be incredibly exciting and inspiring. As it recovered from its explosion and moved through 2017, SpaceX screamed ahead, full force, racing through its backlog of 70 missions worth some $10 billion. With 6,000 employees, it at one point flew back-to-back missions within 48 hours as it gobbled up a larger share of the international launch market. SpaceX was struggling, however, with its Falcon Heavy rocket. It was years behind schedule, and Musk would admit that the heavy lift rocket, which had a total of 27 engines that all had to fire at once, was way, way more difficult than we originally thought. We were pretty naive about that. And he warned that the first launch could end up in a fireball. I hope it makes it far enough away from the pad that it does not cause pad damage. I would consider even that a win, to be honest, he said. Major pucker factor, really. There's no other way to describe it. In the meantime, SpaceX was struggling to meet NASA's rigorous requirements for the Dragon spacecraft that would fly astronauts to the space station. At NASA, there was a feeling among some that all of Musk's Mars talk was a distraction, when what he really needed to focus on was flying the agency's most precious cargo, humans, to the space station. The agency had taken a huge gamble by selecting SpaceX, and it wasn't about to let its astronauts get on the Falcon 9, which had blown up twice, unless it felt confident the rocket was safe. Musk said that was SpaceX's top priority, and had pushed back its timeline for Mars to focus on flying crews to the station. But as if colonizing Mars weren't enough, he was also planning to expand the company's already outsized ambitions and rewrite its future. In early 2017, he made a surprise announcement that it had added a new destination to its itinerary, one it had eschewed up until now. The moon. The mission would take two private citizens on a tourist trip that would orbit the moon and travel faster and further into the solar system than any before them, Musk announced. Musk refused to name the passengers or how much they would pay, but he said the mission would be another step in exceeding the high water mark that was set in 1969 with the Apollo program. They wouldn't land on the lunar surface, but the week-long trip would mark the first time humans had left low Earth orbit in decades. It wasn't as challenging as Mars, but a lunar mission was also exceedingly difficult and ambitious, considering that the company still hadn't flown anyone. The trip would take the passengers well past the moon, some 300,000 miles away, on a circumlunar trajectory, where it would use the moon's gravity to slingshot it back home. Like the takeoff, the return would be perilous. The spacecraft would be flying as much as 40% faster as it hit Earth's atmosphere than would a return trip from the space station. And it had a very narrow window to it, or else it would bounce off the atmosphere and skip off into space. In Guadalajara, Musk had unveiled a behemoth of a rocket that was so ambitious and mind-bogglingly large that critics said it was detached from reality. Since then, he had done some editing, and he presented a revised plan in September 2017 to build a massive, but more reasonably sized, version of what he called the BFR, or Big Fucking Rocket. But while its size had been scaled back, its ambitions had not. In addition to helping create a city on the Red Planet, the new BFR would be capable of helping create a base camp on the moon. It's 2017. We should have a lunar base by now, he said during a speech. What the hell has been going on? In a surprise twist, he also said that the massive rocket and spaceship, which would have more pressurized passenger space than an Airbus A380 airplane, could also fly people anywhere across the globe in less than an hour. Traveling at a maximum speed of nearly 17,000 miles per hour above Earth's atmosphere, a trip from New York to Shanghai, for example, would take 39 minutes, he said. Los Angeles to New York could be done in 25. If we're building this thing to go to the moon and Mars, why not go other places as well? He asked. The new system would be capable of flying astronauts and cargo on an array of missions, including to the International Space Station in low Earth orbit. It could also launch satellites, he said, all of which would allow it to effectively replace the Falcon 9, Falcon Heavy, and Dragon spacecraft. In other words, after disrupting the industry, SpaceX would now attempt to disrupt itself. But he made it clear that Mars remained the ultimate goal. During his talk, a chart showed that SpaceX planned to fly two cargo missions to Mars by 2022, a very ambitious timeline. That's not a typo, he said, but aloud, it is aspirational. By 2024, he said the company could fly four more ships to Mars, two with about 100 human passengers each, sleeping two or three to a cabin, and two more cargo-only ships. SpaceX had proven itself again and again in a series of improbable feats. It had a string of successful launches. It had pulled off landings no one thought possible. It had competed and won against the Alliance. It had had its failures, but had bounced back each time with triumphant launches. And now, as the hare tore down the track, making yet another audacious prediction that blurred the line between reality and fantasy, something remarkable was happening, at least in some corners. People were starting to believe. As Musk announced his plans to go to the moon, Bezos had been secretly talking to NASA about a lunar mission of his own. Blue Origin distributed a secret plan it called Blue Moon to the leadership of NASA, urging it to back an Amazon-like delivery service that would bring cargo and supplies in support of a future human settlement of the lunar surface. It is time for America to return to the moon, this time to stay, Bezos told the Washington Post after it obtained a copy of the 7-page report. A permanently inhabited lunar settlement is a difficult and worthy objective. Flights to the moon could begin by 2020, he said, but only in partnership with the space agency. But he was ready to invest my own money alongside NASA to make it happen. As President Obama had pointed NASA toward Mars, he said of the moon that we have been there before. It was technically true. Men had left flags and footprints on the moon. But they hadn't been there in the permanent way Bezos and others were now proposing. Bezos planned on landing cargo in a series of missions at Shackleton Crater, at the moon's south pole, where there was nearly continuous sunlight that could power the spacecraft's solar arrays. And in the shadow of the crater, scientists had made the huge discovery of water ice. Water is not only key to human survival, but the oxygen and hydrogen could be used as another resource. Fuel. Making the moon, then, a giant gas station in space. Orbiting Earth, the International Space Station held a permanent, if small, colony. Now the moon could too. But it could be bigger, with room for several nations to set up camps side by side. Robert Bigelow, who was building inflatable space habitats that could be used to orbit the moon, said that Mars is premature at this time. The moon is not. Bezos believed that as well. I think that if you go to the moon first and make the moon your home, then you can get to Mars more easily, he said. And so, the moon. Again, the moon. The greatest achievement in the history of humankind, revisited. Only now, so much time had passed that the 12 Apollo astronauts who had walked on the lunar surface were dying off, one by one. James Irwin, Apollo 15, was the first to go, in 1991. Alan Shepard, Apollo 14, died 7 years later. Pete Conrad, Apollo 12, passed a year after that. Then Neil Armstrong, Apollo 11. then Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14. In January 2017, Gene Cernan, Apollo 17, the last man to walk on the moon, died. As he departed the lunar surface, Cernan said that, "We leave as we came, and God willing, as we shall return, with peace and hope for all mankind." He predicted that the return would be followed with a next giant leap, to Mars, by the end of the 20th century, if not sooner. Now, it was nearly 50 years since the height of the space age. The Apollo astronauts had blazed a trail that no one followed. Their prophecies left unfulfilled. Here, though, was a new generation, one ready to resurrect the dreams of their childhood, replicate the feats of their heroes, inspire as they had been inspired. Bezos was 5 when he watched Armstrong walk on the moon. Musk had not yet been born. But with their massive fortunes and ambition, they were reenacting the Cold War space race, a pair of space barons starring in the roles of nations, hoping to pick up where Apollo had left off more than a generation earlier. Their race to the stars was driven not by war or politics, rather by money and ego and adventure. A chance to extend humanity out into space for good. They had taken their mark, and the starter had fired his gun. The hare burst forward, kicking up a plume of dust. Head down, plow through the line. The tortoise plodded along, step by step, repeating quietly, "Slow is smooth, and smooth is fast." The race had been years in the making, but it had only just begun. It would continue down a long and unforeseeable path until the years turned to decades, and the decades into generations, lasting long after the tortoise and the hare were gone. A race past even their own imaginations, deep into the cosmos, to a point in the beyond where there was no finish line. This has been a Hachette audio production of The Space Barons, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the quest to colonize the cosmos. Written by Christian Davenport. Read by Will Collier. Produced by Dennis Kao. Directed by Vanessa Melendez. Sound edited by Mike Sandoval. Mixing and mastering by Jeremy Wesley. Production supervised by Christine M. Farrell. The Space Barons is also available in print and digital formats from Public Affairs, an imprint of Perseus Books, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio Productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2018 by Christian Davenport. Audio production copyright 2018 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.